Okay, so, wow, I just got louder. The big picture of 1 Peter, I want us to be reminded of, but even before then, I will probably start every class with this question: what is our theme this year, and specifically, what is our theme this quarter? Healing in His wings, and specifically this quarter, bringing healing to the world, exactly. And so as we look at the things in 1 Peter, I want us to have that always kind of in, at least in the back of our mind, if not the forefront of our mind, as we're looking at these things. How do I apply them to myself? How do I make them part of what I do day by day so that I can bring healing to the world? That is really our goal today and through this study, that we apply it to ourselves in that way. And so I want you to be thinking about that. I appreciate what Brother Dave had said on Wednesday night, that we have to keep the big picture really of what Peter is talking about and who Peter is talking to as we look at these things, so that we can apply them most appropriately to ourselves. He's talking to Christians in the first century. And the setting for the first century is completely different than ours. As we've been looking at 1 Peter chapter 3 already, where he's talked to wives. Prior to that, he talked to slaves. And then he talks with husbands. In general, he talks with all of us. And the setting, really, in the first century was completely different than what we experience. And so when we look at those instructions, I want you to kind of have that in mind. How many people here have studied 1 Peter before this class? Sometime in the past. All right, we as a congregation actually did about 6 years ago, but our congregation looks completely different. I mean, significantly different than it did then. I've been here for a long time. But many of you have been here. How many of you are here within the last 6 years? Oh, yeah, see? And so you wouldn't have been in that class anyway. Not that you would remember it. It was Shane. So when we think about the first century in Peter's time, we've already mentioned the picture of slaves, completely different than what our mindset has. Our mindset is completely tainted by the 19th and 20th century slavery that we're familiar with. That first century slave situation was completely different, and they had rights, and they had some dignity. And so when Peter approaches them, he's talking to them as Christians and how they can operate in their normal daily life as a Christian. And that's something that I think that we should all consider, because we all have our own situations. We work in different places. We go to school in different places. We have different relationships. We have all sorts of relationships with people that are outside of our family congregation here. You work with people. You have to come in contact with them. You shop. I mean, all of these things. And if we're bringing healing to the world, how we conduct ourselves in those situations is critical. It's critical. It really is a study in taking our Christianity outside of these walls and applying it to every situation in our lives. When we ended on Wednesday night, we had just talked about husbands. And I just wanted to commend Reagan Haley for his observation in his lengthy experience as a husband. And, you know, all of the time that he has spent in that role, the insight that he had in regard to how much easier much easier is it for a husband to go to heaven with the help of his wife than it is without. And it was insightful, and I joke a little bit about that. They're newlyweds. But it's so true. And so as you consider healing to the world, it really has to start with ourselves. All right, we're going to look at 1 Peter chapter 3, and we're going to start in verse 8. He has talked now at the end of chapter 2 with the slaves. He's talked at the beginning of chapter 3 to the wives. In the passage that we just spoke about in chapter 3 and verse 7, he's spoken to the husbands. And in verse 8, he says, finally. Now, I'm reading from the ESV, but the implication is all of these things brought together. Finally, let me give you some more instructions. It's kind of like the preacher who at the end of his second point says, finally. Only he's not really done at all, because Peter's really only halfway through the book. And so this is not right like the final conclusion of the book. This is more of these things that I just told you, let me emphasize them. And so he says in chapter 3 and verse 8, finally, all of you have unity of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, a tender heart, and a humble mind. Do not repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, bless. For to this you were called, that you may obtain a blessing. For I'm going to read all the way through 17. This is going to be our task this morning. So in verse 10, he starts quoting. Your Bible's probably offset it with some indentions, and that indicates he's quoting from somewhere. We'll look at that. For whoever desires to love life and see good days, let him keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Verse 13. Now, who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts regard Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. For it is better to suffer for doing good, if that should be God's will, than for doing evil. Okay, so this passage, and as we read through that, I should have said, look for some of the things that we've already been talking about. Because in a sense, this is a small conclusion of Peter's. He has said, finally, and he lists these things that we're talking about. He's talked about hope. He's talked about suffering. He's talked about reviling. And these are all subjects that he has talked about already. Like any good preacher, he is making a repetitive approach to his preaching to these people so that they get the point. And that's for us too, so that we get the point. Finally, in verse 8, finally, all of you have unity of mind. He lists these five things. And I tell you, if we spent the rest of our class this morning talking about these five things in regard to healing the world, our own role in that, I'm sure we'd have a whole lot to say. These five things, unity of mind, what does that mean? What does it mean to have unity of mind? Peter is talking to Christians. So to these Christians, what does it mean to have unity of mind? Pretty simple. Be on the same page. Exactly. Have like-mindedness, a unity of spirit. Be on the same page. Well, how do you accomplish that? You spend time with each other. You talk with each other. You learn about each other. You spend time finding out about their troubles or their rejoicing or all of these things. You rejoice with those that rejoice. You mourn with those that mourn. You spend time together. Unity of spirit. Unity of mind. Sympathy. This word that Peter is using, it may be a little bit different than what we think of, but it is a little bit more akin to understanding. Now, I think sympathy, even in the way that we use it typically, is that, understanding someone's loss, understanding someone's disappointments and their pains, and having sympathy for that. But that certainly should be a characteristic of a Christian to a Christian. And we're going to talk about that, and then we'll apply it outside of that as well. But he's talking to Christians about Christians. What's the next one he lists? Brotherly love. You'll find out I have no fear of silence. I can ask a question and just wait. So just speak up. You don't have to raise your hand. But if you do have a point to make, I just please interrupt me. Say something. Stand up. I'm not real good at seeing hands for some reason. I've got fine vision with my glasses, but I don't see hands very well. I've been told that anyway. Yes, brotherly love. Now, how is that different than what we've already talked about? Okay. Being moved, doing something, having some kind of action. That's exactly right. Jesus said, this is how they will know who you are, that you love one another. Exactly. And so it's not something that's just passive. It is an action. It is an activity that somebody can actually observe. That's what Jesus is indicating, that people will know you're different. They'll know who you are. They'll know you belong to something different. They may not know to call it Christianity, but they'll know you're different because you love one another. I mean, this is our family. And we treat each other like family. And when people outside see that, see how we care for one another, that has an impact on them. A big impact. Going on, what's the next one? A tender heart. And what does that mean, Paul? That wasn't me. That was you. Are we okay? I don't know where we were at. Tender heart. So these things grow on each other. They build on each other. We've talked about sympathy, but that really is a critical part of tenderheartedness. And you know, when we talk about these things, I don't want us to just arbitrarily go through this list. I hope that by way of application, we're looking deeply inside of ourselves. We can be complacent. We can just kind of go with the flow and day by day do the same thing, get into a rut, go to work, talk to the same people, do the same things over and over and over, and not really consciously be making a decision about the things that are in this list. And it's not just this list, obviously, but here Peter lists these things by way of drawing the conclusions about how slaves interacted with their masters. And by implication, how masters would interact with their slaves, how wives interact with their husbands, how husbands interact with their wives. And he says, finally, all of these things. And these applied to every one of those situations. And so I hope that as we consider these things, that's what is in our thought process. How does this apply to me? And then finally, after tender-hearted, what's the last one that he says? Humble. Humble. In the first century, that would have been a completely foreign idea. And quite honestly, even in our own society, humility is not something that we see every day. I mean, you can see that at the stop sign. Right? Who goes next? No, I stopped first. I got here first. I mean, and that's just a simple little illustration because I'm guilty of it, and I know. But humility is not something to just take for granted. It's kind of like brotherly love that requires action. It requires being a particular way, doing certain things, being humble. Yes. So that we can be like Christ. And who was our example of humility? Christ on the cross, certainly. As we've talked about already this morning, but when we consider ourselves as Christians, calling ourselves by the name Christian, and we consider what Christ has done by way of humility, that puts a lot of onus on us to be like Christ. He said already, be ye holy as I am holy. Haley. Right. Yes, I think that's a great observation. I've studied the Sermon on the Mount several times, and one of the things that's interesting when you go through the Beatitudes, and you've got that list, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are the merciful, blessed are all of these things, we almost look at that as, well, I'm good at that, I'm in that list. When actually Jesus is describing a Christian, he's describing a follower of him in all of those things. And so the same kind of thing here with Peter. This is a description. This is not just, yeah, I did that today. That's a good observation. Somebody else had a hand up? Brother Dave. Humble-minded is the opposite of arrogance. And arrogance is simply thinking way too much of yourself. Thinking too highly of yourself. And humility is exactly the opposite. Very good observation. Yes, sir. Exactly. And I'm glad that you brought the next point in, because that's exactly the point of verse 8. All of these things that he has just said, this is who you should be, because you are going to be reviled. Now, he's talking to his first century Christians. He's talking to the situation that they are in. They've not, apparently, been experiencing physical persecution on the whole. This has been what? Reviling? What else? Slandering? Maligning? These are the things that these Christians are facing right now, and then that's what he brings back to their mind. Do not repay evil for evil, or reviling for reviling. And he's going to say something else about that as well. But isn't that all of our tendency? It doesn't matter what century we're in. When we are maligned, when we are slandered, when we are hurt, when we are oppressed, the natural response to that is to fight back. It's very American. It's very human, but we live in a society that really promotes it. And I would say in the last generation promotes it even more so than any other time. Fight back. You have rights. And there's a balance there, I get that. But what Peter is saying is you will look different. Nick, you had something to say. Very good. And I think the key to it is what Peter says, don't repay evil with evil. I mean, did Jesus ever, not physically, ever fight back? Be careful with that word. I mean, not physically. What about his interactions with the Pharisees and the scribes? Yeah, he would. And as a matter of fact, Peter's going to address that in just a verse 15, when he says, you be ready to give a defense. And I guess that's what I meant by balance. You've got some kind of reaction, but you don't repay evil for evil. You don't repay reviling for reviling. You don't stoop to the lowness that they have attacked you with to attack back at. And so, but that's the human nature. Like Dave says, that's our natural response. And so we have to fight against that. And that's when we have to decide, make a decision, that we're going to be like this. This is who we're going to be. We're going to be united in spirit with our brethren. We're going to have brotherly love. We're going to be tenderhearted. We're going to be sympathetic. That's a decision. It's a choice that we physically make so that we can make these kinds of reactions, not evil for evil, not reviling for reviling. Haley. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And we'll get there. I promise. Well, I'm not going to make promises I can't keep. That's my intention. We're headed that direction. Okay, so in all of these things, don't repay evil for evil. Don't revile, reviling for reviling. Why? And somebody's already mentioned it. I think Nick had read a little ahead. But on the contrary, the end of verse 9, bless, for to this you were called. Why? that you may obtain a blessing. This reminds me very much of what Jesus says when his disciples ask him, teach us how to pray, and he says about forgiveness. What? Father, forgive us? As we forgive others. That puts a lot of responsibility on us when we go to God in prayer to ask him for forgiveness, that we have made sure that's what we are. Well, how do we obtain a blessing? We be a blessing. You don't get that without being that. Okay, and then in verse 10, he is going to quote from a passage in the Old Testament. Who has the cross reference on that? Where are we? Psalm 34. Now, it's interesting to me because he quotes it specifically, and we can go to Psalm 34, and I want us to. Let's turn over to Psalm 34. because he quotes it specifically here from verses 12 through 16 in the psalm and reads it. But I want us to see some other things. Peter has been using Psalm 34 for a little while he is writing this letter to these Christians. So Psalm 34, the passage that we're looking at, like I said, is in verse 12 through 16. You can either read it in 1 Peter, or you can read it in the psalm from David, but it's nearly word for word. But this psalm, most of you should have some kind of title, not what the authors of your publishing company put on it. Mine says, "Taste and see that the Lord is good." But underneath that, at the title of your Psalm 34, what does yours say? Somebody read that to me. All right, do you remember this story? Do you remember the situation that David finds himself in? He was a Jew, right? He was a Hebrew, I should say, an Israelite. But he was on the run from Saul. And to avoid Saul, where did he go? Who is Abimelech? He was the king of the Philistines, exactly, the Philistines. How are you? You know, Caribbean, something. Anyway, the Philistines. That is the last place that Saul would have looked for him at. But how does he get away with that? How does he go to the Philistines and take cover there? He pretends to be insane. That's exactly right. And so this psalm is in regard to him being a sojourner, being an exile away from his Hebrew brethren and spending time with the Philistines. Does this sound familiar? He is an exile, just like Peter is making all of these points about being an exile. And so it's not unlikely that Peter would go to Psalm 34 and use a lot of this. Look, we've already seen in... I wrote it down. Anyway, look how the psalm starts. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. How does Peter start his letter? 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 3. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, according to his great mercy. then in verse 8 of Psalm 34. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Does that sound familiar? Taste of the Lord. Peter uses that in chapter 2 and verse 3 when he says, "The Lord, have you not tasted that the Lord is good?" Uses that same kind of language. Jesus is an example of how to deal with reviling and persecution all through this book and through Peter's letter, and all through Psalm is talking about the sojourners being persecuted, David specifically. There's other examples as well. Verse 4 of chapter 34, I sought the Lord and he answered me and he delivered me from all my fears. Who's using a different translation? What other words does that verse end with? Anybody using like maybe the old King James? Or it may be translated sojourners. Now, that wouldn't that have been David's fear? I mean, he is in the land of the Philistines. He is a Hebrew, and he's pretending. If he gets caught, there's going to be repercussions. And so he is fearful in this sojourning. Well, that's exactly the same word that Peter uses in chapter 1 and verse 17. When he says, and if you call on him as Father who judges impartially according to each one's deeds, conduct yourselves with fear throughout the time of your exile. The word that Peter has as exile is the same word that David uses in verse 4 for fears. Fearful sojourning. Because you are going to be persecuted. You are going to be reviled. You are going to be slandered. You are going to be maligned. And so Peter's been using Psalm 34 quite a bit. And now he uses this passage in verse 10 of chapter 3. Whoever desires to love life and see good days, let him keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. Isn't that exactly what he's just said? He's quoting this as a proof text for what he is instructing them. Be tenderhearted, be kind, be loving, brotherly love, be humble. Don't use your tongue to speak evil. And that's what David was saying in Psalm 34. Going on, he says, let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayer. And before we finish that verse, these are the ways that our prayers are not hindered before God. How we conduct ourselves with our brethren. And how we conduct ourselves with our brethren has a huge impact on everybody that's watching us. And people are watching us. All of those people that we talked about before, all of the people that we come in contact with, the people that we work with, the people that you shop with, the people, everybody who sees you, what do they see? These are the ways that we're different from the world. Do you have a comment?
Yeah, I was going to mention all the things that we've been talking about, all of the characteristics, and the way you summarize that. When you look at these characteristics, these aren't just self-contained feelings that he's saying that we need to make sure we have. These are manifest feelings in which engage one another. They're the things that's going to pour out amongst the brethren there. In other words, these aren't, you make sure that you know the Lord, make sure that you know his righteousness, make sure that you know. In other words, those are all just individual things. But all of these things, in order to have unity, that involves more than one person. That's why he starts off, all of you have these things. In order to have sympathy, that means it's an engaging characteristic to have sympathy. Brotherly love, tender-hearted, humble mind. In order to be humble, you have to have other people in which you are humble too. It's almost like, you know, my kids joke about Donald Trump. I'm a humble guy. I'm the most humble guy that you'll ever meet. Well, you just saying that a million times doesn't manifest itself into humility, you know? And that's why when you summarize this and this idea, it's all pointing towards how we treat one another.
How we treat one another. And how we look like as a family is what I'm talking about is visible to others. Or it should be. Should be. You know, how we spend our time with one another, how we treat one another, should be. Dave? I think that's a good summary. And that's really what this next section, after he has quoted that, is about, going back to the defense of our hope. Now we're outside of this group that we're having all of these characteristics with. And like Dave says, now we have to take those characteristics outside. We have to be ready to give a defense of those characteristics, because those characteristics are part of the hope. That's the hope that we have. It's those characteristics that really are Jesus's, that we are emulating, that we have a defense for, that we need to have a defense for, that we want to live in front of others so that they would ask us that, so that they would want to come here. I think that's a great summary as we go into that section. But at the end of verse 12, David in his psalm, and Peter as he's quoting it, says, "But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil." So, in the context of evil for evil, or reviling for reviling, or slander for slander, or maligning for maligning, who is going to be the judge? Everybody. God is, of course. And so, it's incumbent upon us not to be that one, not to return evil for evil, because God is going to do it. Other places we're told, you know, God is an avenger. God is going to repay all of the evil the way that it should be. But he will do it justly and justifiably. It's not our place. God will repay. One of the fastest, most effective ways of standing out against the world is to not retaliate. Not retaliate. So, now, verse 13, who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? Now, think in first century terms. What's the obvious answer Peter is asking here? It sounds like, and it is, a rhetorical question. Peter is delivering that. So what's the obvious answer? Nobody. But don't we know that the first century Christians did have persecution, actual physical persecution? So this talks a little bit about the timing of this book. This is most definitely before any of that real huge empire affecting persecution came on Christians. So, you know, Nero is known for persecuting Christians, but he wasn't always that way. He was never a good emperor. He was a horrible emperor. But he didn't blame the Christians and start persecuting the Christians right away. There was a time period. And so this is before that. And Peter says, if you're just doing good, who is there to harm you? Nobody. That's going to change. But at the time that he writes this letter, nobody. Now, we could look at our own situations and kind of say that. We can do good in here without a whole lot of fear in our country. But that may not always be. And those are the instructions that Peter is giving to these people. Right now, it's not. But he follows it up immediately with the chance that it is going to be. Because verse 14 says, but even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, what? You'll be blessed. I mean, that's the opposite, right? Isn't physical harm to you, do we count that as a blessing? Not usually. But if we're doing it for the sake of Christ, because we are exhibiting all these things we've been talking about, because we are a Christian, because we do have this family and we're concerned about their well-being, and we're maligned for it or even physically persecuted, we'll be blessed. And that's what Peter's telling his listeners here. But even if you are, and you do suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them. Interesting. Does your Bible set that off, that little quotation? It may quote it. It may set it in different text or something, but have no fear of them, nor be troubled. That is a direct quote from Isaiah. Those of you that had studied in the adult class in a couple of quarters ago studied Isaiah. You remember King Ahaz? Ahaz was not a good king. He was a wicked king, but he was afraid of Israel and Syria joining forces and coming to attack him. And Isaiah goes to him and says, God has said they're not going to do that. Have no fear of them. And Peter is quoting that specifically. But the very next verse in Isaiah is that the Lord is holy. Count him as holy. And the reference in Isaiah of the Lord is all capitals. I know we're done, but we're not done. Was that the first or second bell? Oh, maybe they'll give us a third one. The very next passage is God is holy. The Lord is holy. Yahweh is holy. Look what Peter says next. Verse 15, but in your hearts regard Christ the Lord as holy. Always being prepared to make the defense. And we'll talk about that on Wednesday night as we go into the end of the book. But Peter is equating holiness that Isaiah is talking about as attributed to God as equated to Jesus. That he is God. That he is the Father. He is all one in one. Thank you all very much for your comments. We'll look forward to Wednesday night when we look at some challenging verses there.